Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Joe Queen. And Joe, how you doing?
I'm just doing absolutely great.
Super. Well, I've really been enjoying your new book, and it's one of my favorites of the year, and I was hoping to talk to you about it, and here we are. The book is called One for the Books, and this is kind of about your love affair with books, isn't it?
Yes, it's about my obsession with books, and it's about how books have structured my life in a way that very few people have had. So many things, every conversation with me comes back to books, and my daily life is structured around reading, because I read at least 4 hours a day, and that makes you certainly makes you unusual for a man in the United States, because at the very beginning of the book, the first sentence is the average American reads 4 books a year. And some people have questioned that. I actually think that number might be high. I think the average American man reads maybe 1 book a year, and it's no good. Women read books, particularly like women who listen to NPR and, you know, go to the library. But I think the average man reads either 0 or 1 book a year, and the book's terrible.
Sometimes I'll be on a plane and I'll check out what other people are reading, and I'll look over and I'll see some guy on the other aisle and he'll be reading the new Rush Limbaugh, the new Geraldo Rivera, and I always think, you know, that's probably the only book he's going to read this year.
Yeah, and it would be better just to read, like, How to Dispose of Your Utensils than to read those books, because they're moronic, you know. I think that... my wife only reads really big books. She likes Victorian books. So she reads Henry James. She reads Anthony Trollope. She reads Charles Dickens. And last summer, she was reading Little Dorrit. And we were on a beach in Connecticut for about 3 days. And she just sat there reading that book. And she's reading it very intently. And I walked up and down the beach to see if anybody else was reading Little Dorrit. And as you can well imagine, they weren't. But in fact, nobody on the beach was reading anything. People on the beach, that whole thing about beach reading, that's done too. People just play with their phones now. So people check their emails, they text, they might listen to some music, but the whole idea of going to the beach and reading a book, that's done too. I think people read when they commute, but they're not reading Little Dorrit. And that was one of the things that I really admired about my wife, and it's true of a lot of English people, is that they're just oblivious to the world around them. They just don't care. So she just sat there reading that, and then after she finished Little Dorrit, she read The Old Curiosity Shop, and that's the one with Little Nell, I think. Mm-hmm. I've never read it, but I remember that Oscar Wilde said, "One must have a heart of stone not to laugh at the death of Little Nell." I thought that was pretty funny.
I heard a rumor you finally finished Middlemarch. Is that really true?
Yeah, how did you hear that?
You know, I just, what was it, 34 years it took you?
Yeah, I read it, I finished it on Labor Day of this year. And I must say, it started to pick up a little bit of energy around page 700. But when I finished reading that book, people that I know who really like it, I know one man who really likes it, and everybody else that I know who loves it is a woman, and they will tell you that it's the greatest book of all time. When I finished reading it, I felt that it was two stories that had been grafted together that didn't have anything to do with each other, and afterwards I went back and read the introduction, and in the introduction, that's exactly what happened. She had written two entirely different stories. One about a railroad coming to a small town in England and how it was going to disrupt the society, and the other a love story. And I didn't like Middlemarch because I didn't find any of the characters attractive at all. I found the main character, Dorothy, to be just an insanely stupid. And her husband was horrible. And the guy she was in love with was a sort of callow youth who would have been played by James Franco or somebody even worse. And everything about the book I just found horrible. I just hated it. I mean, I admire her writing. I read other books by her. I really liked Silas Marner, and The Mill and the Floss was okay. But I just found it an unbearable experience, and yet I was determined to get through, and I did. And it took 34 years. So, you know, you can, if you put your mind to something, you can do it. But I got to tell you, it was hard. It was really like the hardest thing that I ever did.
That is monumental that you actually managed to do that.
Right. And the thing is that I've read other really long books. Like I read Robert Musil's Man of Qualities, or I almost finished reading it because he didn't finish writing it. He wrote about 1,000 pages, and then there's about 600 extra pages that go with it. I read that book in about 3 weeks because that's a fantastic book. And it's also very easy to read. It's not like reading James Joyce. Ulysses is brutal, of course. And Proust is hard to read because the sentences are dense and because nothing ever happens. Like the third volume of Remembrance of Things Past is almost entirely devoted to a party. And the book's 580 pages long. So that's a lot of time to devote to a party. But Robert Musil's book is really easy to read, and it's a very entertaining book, and I'm going to read it again next year. I really enjoyed that book very much. Nobody that I know, the only people that I know who have read that book are people that I gave it to. I've never met anybody else who had read it, and yet that is truly one of the greatest books ever written. It's an amazing book.
Joe Queenan joins us. His new book is One for the Books. I see where recently NBC asked you to name those three books that you wanted to read before the end, and you named a couple books that you really, really want to read, and that's Philip Roth's Great American Novel and Homer's The Iliad. And then the third book is one of those books that I think you have it locked up in a box somewhere.
Geraldo Rivero's Exposing Myself.
That's one of the books that you call moronic or despicable, isn't it?
He's a horrible human being. He's a truly vile human being who, he's one of the classic examples of the horrible journalist who commoditizes other people's misfortune. And as soon as something bad happens, that's an opportunity for him to advance his career. And I truly think he's a despicable human being. And that's a horrible book, because that book tells lots and lots of stories about women that he seduced and about horrible things that he did that should totally discredit him as a journalist. It's a truly repulsive and horrendous book. But the reason that I put it on that list is because if the world is going to come to an end tomorrow, according to the Mayan calendar, well, reading a book like that makes you feel okay that the world's going to end, because you don't have to be on the same planet as Geraldo Rivera anymore. So there's a consolation prize. And the other two books that I put in there, The Great American Novel is a book told by a sports writer who's in a nursing home, and he's recounting the adventures of a third baseball league, I think it was called the Patriot League, that the entire society has agreed to forget ever existed. And that book is truly amazing, and anybody who has ever tried to write satire would just read that book and just be staggered by it, just be totally staggered. And that book is always, whenever they talk about Philip Roth's great stuff, like, The Ghost Writer and The Counter Life and things like that, American Pastoral, they always leave that book off and just sort of throw it to the side. And to me, that just shows that critics are idiots, because anybody who actually is a writer would just read that book and just be totally blown away by how gifted he was and how funny it is. It's a really, really funny book. I love that book. I read that book like 5 times.
As your wife was reading Dickens on the beach and you saw all those people playing with their smartphones, I'll bet you some of them were reading books, but that's kind of a repulsive idea, isn't it, that people read books on those little things? In fact, you have a problem with electronic books in general, and this is another thing where I really connected with you, because I'm the same kind of Luddite. I figure if I got to read an e-book, I might as well just not even read it, because there's nowhere for marginalia. There's nowhere to do all the stuff you do with a real book.
Yeah, I love the physical presence of a book in my life for several days. I love to come back to it. I think of it as a sacred object, not because it's collectible or because it has an autograph in it by William Styron, but just because it's a wonderful object. And I like turning pages, and I write, I underline lines. And part of the reason that I underline lines is when I was young, I did it because that's how you learn to write. You underline things, and then you write it into a notebook. And by writing the things down, you learn the people's rhythms, and that's how you learn to write. And I don't think that people like Geraldo or Rush Limbaugh ever did that. I don't think that, or whoever, like, ghost writes books for those people. I don't know. But when you do that, you learn how to write, like writing down Oscar Wilde's paradoxes and things. But the other thing is that it's a way of really paying homage to the writer when you underline things. I remember reading Julius Caesar and Macbeth, and I went back to look at them a few years later, and I think I'd underlined every line, because those two plays in particular are just filled with memorable phrases and turns of phrases that were expressions that were used as book titles, and it's just amazing. And there's a lot of other books. I remember reading Death Comes for the Archbishop by Willa Cather, and she's a fantastic writer. And that book is interesting because in other Willa Cather books, there are pyrotechnics. There are things that you underline where you go, that is truly a beautifully crafted phrase. In My Antonia, there's stuff like that. And there's also stuff like that in My Mortal Enemy, which is a beautiful, beautiful book. But in Death Comes for the Archbishop, I don't think that there was a single line that I underlined. There wasn't any sentence that just jumped out at you. And that's quite a tribute to a writer, to be able to write a brilliant book without writing any particular sentence that totally blows you away. That, taken to an extreme, of course, is what happened in the 70s and the 80s with blunted affect writing like Anne Beattie. And I think that that's true to this day, that there are writers who come out of writer's school who they would be mortified if they ever wrote a sentence that anybody would say, that's a great sentence. They don't want people to say, there's a writer here who wrote this stuff. They just want it to appear that the words just kind of got on the page somehow. And I like to read a book and always come across something and just say, I can't believe somebody could write a sentence like that. Mm. Like, I remember I was just reading Human Voices by Penelope Fitzgerald. I've read that three times, and it's a book about the BBC during the Second World War. And I suppose one of the reasons I love the book is because I've worked in the building in London where they were all bunkered in during the war. And I've spoken into microphones that very well may have been spoken into by Winston Churchill and Charles de Gaulle. So there's a sense of you're entering this holy temple when you go into that building. And there was a sentence in that book that I just thought was really funny where she said that Asra was the kind of girl, she was the kind of girl who got jobs because she was the kind of girl that people gave jobs to. And I just thought that's such a beautiful way of expressing something. It's just so casually expressing things. And the book was filled with wonderful, wonderful things like that. Her books are amazing. Her books are great. And I underlined lots and lots of things there. So with e-readers, I don't care if people read them. It doesn't make any difference to me. If people read, that's great. And I know that lots of people who like to take like 12 books on their summer vacation put them on their e-reader. But I suspect that if you put 12 books on your e-reader, they're all bad books. They're just like stupid mysteries and stuff. If you're going on a summer vacation, you probably really only have time to read like one or two good books. And I don't take trash on my summer vacations. I'll read trash like on the train, you know, like if I'm coming from Washington, and I'm not using the term trash in a pejorative sense, because I like trash. I'm not going to name any particular writers, but there's lots of mystery writers who write really, really entertaining books that you can read on the train. And I'm sure if you talk to them, certainly off the record, they'd say, yeah, it's trash. Mm. You know, it's good trash, but it's just trash. There's nothing, I don't think, even including the Sherlock Holmes books, I don't think there's anything in that entire genre that's in any way illuminating. Mm. I think like one page of Charles Dickens or Jane Austen is worth all mysteries that were ever written. And people will talk about how a particular writer transcends the genre. No, they don't. None of those writers transcend the genre. Even the great ones like Arthur Conan Doyle and Simenon, they don't transcend the genre. They're as good as that genre can be, but they don't transcend it. Really, really great writers are really, really great writers. And they're not like that. They're clever. They tell interesting stories, but they're not brilliant. And they don't tell you anything about the world that you don't know. And that's really what you really are looking for in great fiction. There's something about it that transports you out of the world and makes you look at the world in a different way.
Joe Queenan joins us. His new book is One for the Books. And I'm visualizing that astute reader who actually downloaded this book into the Kindle for the summer reading, and the look of consternation as they're reading it and reading what you're saying about those devices.
But my ace in the hole as a writer and as a human being has always been that I don't care.
Right.
I don't care what people think about anything. If they like it, that's great. If they don't like it, that's great. It doesn't make any difference to me. Most people want to be liked. But if you look at what satirists do, by their very nature, you're making enemies all the time. Uh-huh. So your heroes are people like Molière or Cyrano de Bergerac is a perfect example. You're not looking to make friends. You're looking to stick up, you know, put a stick in people's eyes. So if people like the stuff that I write, that's fine. And if they don't like it, that's fine, too. Uh-huh. It's all a horse race. It doesn't make any difference to me. You know, if people read it on a Kindle or an e-reader or read it on their phone, that's great. Because my opinions are my opinions. They don't have to be other people's opinions. You know, young people are going to be reading e-readers, and there's nothing that we can do about it. Mm-hmm. So all you can do is hope that people read something.
When I read your stuff, Joe, and I always look forward to it, it reminds me a little bit of those occasions when we give our dog one of those raw lamb shanks and they strip the meat off it right away and get down to the bone and just gnaw on it and crunch it and make all this noise, and they're having so much fun and they get right down to the marrow, and I think that's Queenan. And
that's so nice of you to say that. I mean, there's one thing about the stuff that I do is people think when you write funny stuff that it's easy to write. Essays are easy to write. Opinion pieces are easy to write, but books aren't easy to write. Books are worked on. Books are like canvases. If you look at really good paintings, there's a lot more than just on the surface. There's layers. They've gone back and worked on that, and that's what you do with a book. With a book, you just keep working on it, and you try to make it better. So it's a completely different thing from writing an essay, and you try to squeeze in as much stuff as you can. A lot of times when I write things, people will say, well, you left out this or you didn't mention that. And I figure, you got like 3,000 jokes. Shut up. You know,
yeah.
I mean, really, yeah. You know, they're like, well, you should, how did you leave this out? Shut up. You got your money's worth. Uh-huh. It's like with encores. When I go to hear great musicians play at Carnegie Hall, they shouldn't have to play an encore. They already gave you the show.
Uh-huh.
You already got your money's worth. Go home.
Got that. You have a lot of fun in this book, just kind of picking at things. And you note the fact that on February 11th, 1997, the National Academy of Arts declared that book reviewers need to always use the word astonishing in their reviews.
Yes.
And you point out that if you want to read reviews of books, maybe you should just read the customer reviews on Amazon. Then you give us some fake Amazon reviews. And I really like the one you did for Mein Kampf.
Oh, yeah, what's up with the Jewish thing?
Yeah,
why does he keep using words like Oberkommandant? Yeah, I can imagine people on Amazon.com reviewing books like that and not quite getting it. Like with the Aeneid, I had the person going like, wine, wine, wine. So big deal, your town burned down and you had to move to Rome. Lots of people will be happy to do that. And it's funny because I saw some of the reviews that people did of Thomas Wolfe's new book, Tom Wolfe's new book. And Tom Wolfe is, you know, I'm not crazy. I'm not interested in the novels, but I read all of his nonfiction, and he's a brilliant writer, and he's also a very influential writer. The sense of humor that people have in America largely comes out of Tom Wolfe and Woody Allen, and then like later David Letterman, I think, and there's other things too, you know, like the Family Guy and The Simpsons. But basically, Tom Wolfe has really, really influenced the way an awful lot of people write. And so some people would go on Amazon and totally trash the book and give it like one star. Well, if you give a Tom Wolfe book one star, then what do you do with the Geraldo Rivera book? You know, and there's also just a point, there's a sort of thing that people have. The internet really feeds resentment because so much of what you read on the internet, on blogs, is, it's basically, that should have been me. You know, there's a great song, I think it's a Mose Allison song, that Van Morrison and Georgie Fame sing called It Should Have Been Me. Do you know that song?
Uh-huh.
It goes, it should have been me driving that big, fine Cadillac. And that's like virtually the entire internet is, that should be me on Time Magazine. That should be me being interviewed on NPR. That should be me. Well, it ain't. Sorry, you know, and the reason it ain't is because most people, do you know what I think the worst word in the English language is?
Astonishing?
Amateur.
Oh. Uh-huh.
There's nothing I hate more than amateurs. It's like if you're an amateur sportsman, if you're an amateur writer, if you're an amateur musician, I get paid to do this. You don't get paid to do it. You're an amateur. You are just an amateur, and that's all you are. And people really can't get that through their heads. Like, well, I've got my blog. Well, that's sweet. That's cute. I'm glad you got your blog. But if you don't get paid for it, well, that's what it's worth.
Ooh, ouch.
Ouch indeed.
Well, you are in demand. I see your stuff all over. If we go into that internet and we Google your name, we can come up with things like your article for the Weekly Standard, Goodbye Columbus, A Brief Au Revoir to Our Wonderful State of Ohio.
That was a sweet little story, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like I've been to Ohio many times, and Severance Hall in Cleveland is the nicest concert hall in America, and Cleveland, I think, has the best sports fans, and you know, they have a great museum in Cleveland, and Cincinnati's got a few nice things, and, you know, there's some nice stuff in Columbus. But that state, people just obsess about that state in the 4 or 5 months leading up to the election every 4 years. It's like, oh, my God, I wonder if they're going to be able to turn out the vote in Cuyahoga County. And then as soon as the election's over, nobody talks about Ohio for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just doesn't seem fair. So I wrote that story in the Weekly Standard. Weekly Standard runs a lot of my funniest stories. I had a story in the Weekly Standard earlier this year, which was about, do you remember when that thing happened with CERN in Basel a couple of years ago?
Super collider?
Where they said that they disproved Einstein's theory.
Uh-huh.
And then they had to retract it. And I wrote this story about how, well, I knew that they were wrong because I have one of those colliders in my basement because I bought it from the Lawrence Livermore Institute. They were selling them off. They were selling off, like, the old models for about $2,000. So I had one, and I ran the exact same study in my basement, and I had all the data to prove that Einstein was right, and it was on my computer. But I was really busy last Christmas, and I didn't get around to, like, filing my paper in a scientific journal like Nature or Science. And I think the guys from CERN broke into my computer, hacked in there, and stole all my data. And then, so I wrote that story, and I just love the Weekly Standard for publishing that, because I'm sure so many of their readers must be just like, what is he talking about now? But I love that story. My daughter, who's a neuroscientist, she's getting her doctorate at Georgetown. She just loves it when I write stuff about science. She's just like, it's hilarious, Dad. You don't know anything about, you don't understand Darwin. You don't understand, like, why the dinosaurs died. But it's sweet that you write these crazy scientific stories. My story this week is going to be about, in the Wall Street Journal, is going to be about the Mayan calendar. Because there's a whole bunch of other calendars that people should know about. There's a whole bunch of other calendars in Mesoamerica that predict apocalyptic things happening. So I just wrote about that, and that's another kind of scientific. That's another one where I kind of veer into an area that I'm not really on that solid footing.
I'll be looking for that. Joe Queenan joins us. His book is One for the Books, and it's one of my favorite books this year. And the thing I really like about it is that it's like you wrote it to me. You know, book lovers feel that writers are speaking directly to them, and that's what you say in this book, and that's how I felt about it. And we're running out of time. There's so many things I like to talk about that we don't have time to talk about, like the night you spent at the Thurber House in Columbus. I love that. I love the fact that when you go into a bookstore, they don't treat you well because they think you look like a cop.
They do. Whenever I go into a bookstore, they just treat me horribly. They just treat me like I'm an illiterate, and I'm like, hey, I write books. Bookstore people who work in bookstores often don't like writers because they're not Paul Auster.
Right.
Like, they only like that kind of writer. They're like kind of willowy writers, you know, and the writers who write books that people in France like. And when you write stuff like I write, where you're always making fun of people like Jimmy Carter or something, they get mad. They're like, why are you here? It's like, well, actually, technically speaking, I'm the writer and you're the bookstore employee.
I love that. And then there's a story about the time that your bag got switched, the New York Public Library. But we don't have time to talk about all these great stories. But if our listeners go out and get the book, One for the Books by Joe Queenan, they can enjoy them at their leisure.
And they can download that book onto their phone.
You're right. Or if they get the actual book, they can write little notes where they disagree with you, or they say you're wrong, or they maybe remember a word that they don't understand to look up later.
Yeah, they can. They can just write in the margins, as if. Nice try, pal. I do that all the time. I'm always writing like, yeah, that's funny. But guess what? Virgil said that 2,000 years ago. But I don't write that in Geraldo Rivera books. There's very little in Geraldo or Rush Limbaugh that was said by any of the great writers of antiquity.
Yeah. Well, Joe, it's really been great having you back on the show.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Joe Queenan's been my guest, and his book is One for the Books. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for Simon Tolkien. His new spy novel is Orders from Berlin. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.